there is this extraordinary ability that the Christian story has had to make sense of all other stories.
Welcome to Apologetics Profile. I'm Watchman staff apologist Daniel Ray. Nice to have you along this week. Suppressing the truth of God's existence in unrighteousness is one of the most baleful and obvious effects of original sin on all of us. It is something we all do and have been doing for millennia, and we continue to do it right up to the present day. No one is immune from this sin of unbelief either, as both Christians and non-Christians alike are all guilty of it. We all stand before God without excuse, covering up the knowledge of God out of fear, shame, and sin. After the tragedy of September 11th, 2001, several leading atheist intellectuals took up their pens and wrote excoriating polemics against religion that soon, surprisingly, became bestsellers. The late journalist Christopher Hitchens, neuroscientist Dr. Sam Harris, philosopher Dr. Dan Dennett, and biologist Dr. Richard Dawkins all wrote acerbic tomes taking Christianity, Islam, and religion in general to task. They were soon coined the Four Horsemen of the New Atheism. Perhaps the most notable work of the four is Richard Dawkins' 2006 manifesto, The God Delusion. In the preface of the book, Dawkins wrote that, quote, "If this book works as I intend, religious leaders who open it will be atheists when they put it down," end quote. It seems, however, that quite the opposite has happened. The new atheist movement, which seemed to have such an unstoppable momentum in the early 2000s, has virtually disintegrated into a fragmented and disparate amalgam of online unbelievers who, while sharing a belief that God likely doesn't exist, can't seem to find agreement on much else. In matters of societal concerns, for example, like politics, human rights, race, gender, abortion, and the environment, atheists have struggled to find any other common ground on which they might unite. The new atheism movement has shown that it is quite difficult to unite human beings around a mere polemic. There is much more to the story of our humanity's place within the cosmos. But if God does not exist, then what is left? Whatever are we for? Many intellectuals today, however, rather than rallying around Dawkins' strident anti-theistic rhetoric in The God Delusion, have instead begun rediscovering the coherence, beauty, and wonder of the Christian story. In fact, there has been a new collection of essays recently published about people coming to faith because of The God Delusion. Edited by Dennis Alexander and Alistair McGrath, Coming to Faith Through Dawkins includes the stories of 12 people who came out of the new atheist movement and embraced Christianity. One thing is resplendently clear about the new atheist movement. It has reminded the church of her unique and powerful story, that the way in which God through Christ has communicated to us and with us has been and continues to be through story, the greatest story ever told. The Word of God has once more survived the onslaught of popular ridicule and criticism. The Greatest Story Ever Told is in fact the title of a 2017 book by cosmologist and atheist Lawrence Krauss, whose 2012 book, A Universe from Nothing, had a ringing endorsement by Dr. Dawkins. At the beginning of each chapter of Krauss's Greatest Story Ever Told, he quotes from the Bible. Krauss, however, does not advocate for God's existence, but is attempting to use the physics of the universe, the story of science, to do away with God. We once thought God was the source of all light, according to Genesis, but now we know, according to Krauss, the physics of light, that it behaves as both a particle and a wave, a peculiar manifestation of energy. The greatest story ever told, according to Krauss, is not Jesus' life, death, burial, and resurrection, but the history of science, which Krauss believes has undone the Bible's narrative of divine judgment and love. Nevertheless, Krauss is attempting to tell a story, one of the history of scientific discovery. Krauss even mentions C.S. Lewis's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe in the opening chapter, in an attempt to tell the story that science, and not God, is the portal into, quote, remarkable and potentially terrifying possibilities of the unknown, possibilities that lie just beyond the edge of our senses, just waiting for us to be brave enough to seek them out, end quote. Even for strident atheists like Dawkins and Krauss, narrative remains a key element to better understanding our place in the cosmos. But without God, what serves as the overarching meta-narrative of reality? Even in trying to do away with God, the ardent skeptic must borrow the communicative power of storytelling from God. And though the history of science is indeed a fascinating tale in its own right, many are now beginning to realize that science simply is incapable of being the greatest story ever told. There is much more to our life in the universe than meets the telescope or the test tube. While our universe is certainly filled with all sorts of wardrobes, just waiting to lead us on to exciting, if not terrifying, and new discoveries, by no means has Krauss or Dawkins or any of the other new atheist intellectuals succeeded in doing away with the elegiac, terrifying, inspiring, and beautiful prose of the Bible. It remains the greatest story ever told. And if anything, one aspect of the new atheist movement is that it seems to have brought some people back to the foot of the cross. You have probably often heard the claim that our culture and time has become increasingly secularized. That there is no one story that can explain our seemingly chaotic world. Many scholars point to the Enlightenment, or the advance of science, or the increase in learning and technology, or the growth of a globally connected internet as reasons for the retreat of Christianity. But as our guest this week and next will so wonderfully point out, this secularism is not the end of the story. In fact, he suggests, we may be living in a time where belief in God is indeed making a comeback among many leading intellectuals and scholars. Our guest this week and next is author, apologist, broadcaster, and speaker Justin Brierley from the UK. For the last 17 years, Justin has hosted the widely popular radio program Unbelievable, where believers and skeptics come together for congenial conversations about Christian and non-Christian ideas regarding science, the universe, morality, faith, philosophy, and many other cultural issues. Since 2006, Justin has had a front row seat in listening to the best and most brilliant minds, both Christian and non-Christian alike. I personally credit Justin's ministry as being an inspiration to my own lay and formal engagement and involvement with apologetics over the years. Justin has a new book, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, Why New Atheism Grew Old, and Secular Thinkers Are Considering Christianity Again. I had the wonderful privilege of sitting down with Justin in person recently during his visit to Texas to discuss his new book. Our interview took place in the Fireside Room of Prestonwood Baptist Church in Plano, Texas, during an apologetics conference. We had a delightful conversation about the need to recapture and retell the greatest story ever told for a culture and a time that seems to be increasingly interested to hear what Christianity has to offer. As we began our conversation, I asked Justin what he thought about why new atheism had such a resurgence of interest in the early 2000s. We are in the fireside chat room at Prestonwood Baptist Church in Plano, Texas, and I am with Justin Brierley, who has hopped the pond with his son Noah to be in the United States. He'd been in Florida and now in Texas for the last week or so. Welcome to Texas, Justin.
Thank you. Oh, should I say y'all?
That's pretty good.
Is that good enough? I don't know.
It is. But you have had a successful run in the UK with your show Unbelievable, which has been running, I just heard you share that it's been running for over 17 years.
That's right, yeah.
And it is the reason why I'm doing podcasts myself, at least one big reason. I listened voraciously to Unbelievable back in 2007, more specifically 2009 is when I was starting to listen to back issues. Mm. But your voice on long car trips, it's fantastic to be able to be in person with you and hear the voice that has inspired my road into apologetics.
So that's amazing. You. Well, I've often heard people say when I've met them for the first time, oh, I feel like I know you, Justin, because you've been my companion on long journeys, right. You know, and so on. And it's such a privilege to know that I've been able to be that companion for so many people, even though I've never met them before. But no, it's amazing and a huge privilege, and I'm just so pleased that God has used the show in so many ways.
Yes, and so we are here today talking about apologetics. Your new book is out, The Surprising Rebirth of the Belief in God, Why New Atheism Grew Old, and Secular Thinkers Are Considering Christianity Again. One of my favorite topics that you covered is cosmology. Mm. We'd have some really brilliant physicists, really, really, really brilliant cosmologist on that was an atheist or a skeptic or a materialist talking to a knowledgeable Christian about the cosmos and the science and faith topics. So I thought maybe we could start in the beginning.
Yeah.
You've heard a lot of discussion about Genesis, and we'll get into the demise of atheism in just a minute, but I thought we might begin at the beginning with Genesis, because as you know, for the last decade and so, you've heard a lot of arguments against creation, a lot of arguments against the book of Genesis, talking snakes, talking donkeys. I know that that's later in the text, but the attack on Genesis and on the Bible as a whole is really where I'm going, is it's not aged well for atheism. Mm. It still stands despite the new emphasis on ridiculing it, which happens a lot in social media, as you know. It's still it's still here. It's still informing us. And your book talks about secular thinkers who are going back to the book of Genesis, to the Bible specifically. Jordan Peterson comes to mind. You've mentioned him a lot. Mm. So a couple of questions to begin, Justin. First, how have you seen or what do you think started the new atheism? What was it in your mind, as you've seen with all these conversations, what engendered this, the new aspect of atheism? And why was it popular? We'll just begin there. Yeah. Why do you think that took off?
So I think there were a few factors that led to the rise of new atheism. I think partly it was 9/11 and a kind of response among a certain sector of the population against religious fundamentalism, feeling that this was a danger to the culture and so on. I think the new atheism very much began there, critiquing fundamentalist Islam, but then just generalizing it to religion in general, you know. I think it was partly the rise of the internet. It was the fact that suddenly non-Christian atheists who perhaps felt a little bit, you know, dislocated from each other could suddenly band together in chat rooms and on websites and blogs and so on and feel like they were part of a movement. That was quite a new thing with the way the internet was going. And I think there was also, especially on the US scene, a kind of response to what some felt was a kind of certain type of Christian right that was, you know, had a certain amount of power in the US, and people concerns that existed at the time around teaching of creationism in school or whatever it was. All of these things, I think, came together to kind of give the impetus for suddenly when Richard Dawkins and Harris and Hitchens and others came on the scene with these anti-God books, they suddenly had this publishing boom on their hands. Suddenly lots of people wanted to hear from them, wanted to celebrate this. You saw the rise of atheist rallies and conferences. The Reason Rally in 2012, you know, was this big march on Washington from atheists and skeptics marching for reason and science. So it was just a really interesting moment, you know, and what was new about it was, in a sense, its public face. It was very dogmatic. It was very media savvy. It dealt a lot more in ridicule than like, you know, intellectual arguments effectively. And that was, you know, quite attractive to a number of people at the time who felt like, hey, this is a movement that feels cool, trendy. Maybe they felt like it had this intellectual basis. And so that was kind of how the New Atheism, I think, rose and continued to be quite popular.
How much do you think social media anonymity, you mentioned about the rise of the internet after 9/11, which I certainly think is a factor. How much of the online dialogue, where people are mostly anonymous, even if they have their names and pictures, have influenced or fueled this vitriol and mockery? Do you think there's a contributing factor in the way in which people are communicating today through the technology, that this has exacerbated the contempt that's already there in the human heart, but now that we have this online technology where we can say what we feel without reprisal of an incarnate sort of dialogue?
I think that's right. I think the fact that technology, in a sense, has enabled us to do more communication, but in a more anonymous way, has actually contributed to the way we then feel more able to insult and mock and deride each other.
Right.
I always found when I did the Unbelievable show that the reason I think a lot of people appreciated it was because it went against that. It brought two people together, often face to face.
Right.
And it's much harder to dismiss someone or be rude to them if you're like literally sitting in front of them. It's much easier to do that if you're a kind of sitting behind your keyboard on Twitter or something, and that person is just another, you know, faceless entity to be demolished. So I think that has been the problem with social media, the rise of technology. It's kind of given people an excuse to sort of not see each other as human beings in that sense. And so I think you're right. The New Atheism, in terms of its dogmatic sort of ridicule and that kind of thing, it thrived in that sort of technological era that was coming of age, because you didn't have to sort of live with the consequences of kind of being really rude to someone. And so, I think that all contributed.
So it's not just, of course, there's several factors, as you mentioned, that went into the rise of New Atheism. But really the ideas that we're dealing with, as you outline in your book, are centuries old, pre-Enlightenment, even maybe 17th century, 18th century, where we're getting into the idea that man can be unfettered from theological and religious dogma. You know, dogma has become an epithet, like it's some evil thing. But the idea that goes back to, you mentioned the poem by Matthew Arnold in your book, in your conversation with a gentleman from the UK who's a social critic. I forgot his name.
Douglas Murray.
Douglas Murray. And he made the point to you during your conversation that, you know, Matthew Arnold's poem about religion retreating, a long melancholy roar
of the sea of faith,
of the sea of faith. And, you know, it has tragically, I mean, Arnold, I think, was prophetic in the sense of what he saw, because it seems like since his time and even to the present day, Justin, that this retreat of religion has been a kind of roar that has literally been devouring us. I mean, you mentioned suicide rates in the CDC, and I know in the U.S. for the last several years, 40,000 people a year or more take their own life. That's a soccer stadium or a baseball stadium.
And I mean, I simply make the point that the incoming sort of surge of technology, materialism, secularism that Matthew Arnold was writing about, really, as he talked about this sea of faith going out, while obviously we have the material benefits of science and technology, we live in a arguably more prosperous culture than we ever have before, it is interesting that at the same time we do have these sky-high, you know, rates of anxiety, depression, suicide among young people. And it's almost, it just confirms in a sense that we never can be the savior of ourselves. You know, we're good at creating things, but we just don't seem to be able to actually make ourselves more happy in the process.
Right.
And I guess what I noticed is that maybe that long withdrawing roar of the sea of faith, maybe it won't go on forever, because in that conversation with Douglas Murray that I was having a few years ago, Douglas Murray, someone who terms himself a Christian atheist, interestingly, he doesn't believe in Christianity, but he recognizes that all the values and virtues he does espouse essentially come from the Christian story, not from atheism. He said, well, the thing is, Justin, the sea of faith could come back in again. That is the point of tides.
Hmm.
And he was noticing, even among his intellectual peers, a couple of interesting stories of people converting to Christianity.
Hmm.
And he just sort of wondered aloud, really, whether we might be moving into a time with the new atheism perhaps more in the back window, where people are kind of opening themselves up again to the possibility of the Christian story.
And,
and that just struck me as true in my experience. I was having more and more of these conversations with people like Douglas Murray, who, unlike the new atheists, were no longer simply dismissing Christianity out of hand. They may not believe it, but they saw the value of it. And were possibly even opening up the door for other people to take Christianity a bit more seriously. So that was kind of what led me to, write this new book, this sense that actually something might be changing in the atmosphere, and that tide might be just on the verge of starting to turn.
Yeah, to put a turn on a Lewis phrase, what you believe a lot depends on where you're standing. And so, you know, Matthew Arnold, what he was observing. But if you think about the sea analogy, you know, 3/4 of the Earth's surface is covered in water. And just because I can't see the beach or the ocean doesn't mean that it's not coming back or that the tide's not coming in. And so there's something to that. I think I really like that part of the book, the reminder that, and as you've been saying today in your conferences, that this is not the end of the story. And I like what you said this afternoon, that maybe we're living between the tides, a time when we can prepare for people looking for meaning and purpose. One of the things that you address, and you mentioned Alan Noble, whose book, Getting Out of Bed, I just read, and it got me into You Are Not Your Own, which is a brilliant commentary.
Yeah, I loved that book.
On where we're at and what you're talking about. And for our listeners, if you read Justin's book, I would highly recommend anything that Alan Noble has written to give you more of a cultural assessment of where we are, the long melancholy roar and what it's turned into. And he goes into the idea that the self, we cannot bear the burden. It's like we're all in a room shouting at each other. I don't know if that was your analogy or his, but we're all in a room with megaphones shouting at each other, here I am, exhausting ourselves, trying to create identities for ourselves because the identity that we have in Christ has been lost and forgotten and ridiculed. How can I find solace in a story that these intellectual leaders of our culture, not just the Four Horsemen, but in any discipline, where faith is just so marginalized, it's a fairy tale. How can I find meaning in that? What's gonna
And I loved this point by Alan Noble in that book, You Are Not Your Own. He, as someone who, you know, is a university professor and sees a lot of Gen Z and so on coming through, he was just noticing this kind of almost intolerable burden on young people these days to basically invent their identity from scratch. And I kind of took this idea up in the book that I suppose in that sense it's the loss of the Christian story, I think. I think this is essentially what Noble says as well. As we've lost that overarching story that once gave us a kind of communal sense of purpose, we all had a shared narrative about who we were, how it worked in this story of reality called Christianity. It's been replaced, as we've lost that story in a sort of post-Christian world, it's been replaced by a kind of free-floating, I am kind of just able to invent my own identity from scratch. And then you're given all these options, you know, well, are you going to be this? Are you going to be that? You know, and the problem is, as he points out so well, people can't cope with that. I use a sort of silly analogy in the book, really, but it's a bit like a child who has maybe only ever been given the option of vanilla, chocolate, or strawberry ice cream, suddenly entering some Italian gelateri where they have like 500 options.
He's going to be overwhelmed.
Yeah, and you're overwhelmed. It's kind of almost a paralysis sense because it's like, where do I go? And I see that among this generation, a kind of paralysis almost, because there is this kind of intense pressure to kind of, you know, you have to find this identity, and, you know, you can be cancelled if you don't say the right things at the right time and, you know, advocate for the right causes and everything else. And I just think it creates this mental pressure that is actually contributing to the mental health crisis. You know, why are we living, as I said, in this age when we have more depression, addiction, anxiety than ever before? It's because we're kind of we're kind of self-medicating, and we don't know what to do with ourselves because we don't have a story to make sense of our life anymore. And the stories we are telling just aren't adding up.
Well, I know you've had Alistair McGrath on your show a few times. How many times has he been on?
Oh, gosh, I've lost count, really.
No, really.
I mean, he's been a
fantastic
Christian communicator so long. Yeah.
What's the word for the multi-talented intellectual?
Oh, yeah.
The polymath.
He's a polymath.
He's a polymath. I was at the New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary a couple of years ago, and he came in by teleconference through Zoom to give a presentation on his new book then, Narrative Apologetics. Mm. A wonderful presentation. I have the book here. He made a valid point, but it was funny when he started the presentation, after the presentation was done, he had people line up to ask him questions. And one gentleman was telling the story about why he doesn't like narrative apologetics. And Alistair simply said, well, thank you for your story.
You proved my point.
You proved the point that however we are dictating a worldview. I mean, if you look at the most influential texts, Justin, that have taken us in a secular direction, I mean, I don't think that Copernicus would have thought that that's what he was doing, but so many writers will quote his book, or Galileo mocking his friend, Pope Urban VIII, or Darwin's Origin of the Species, that the most influential ideas have come through storytelling, whether or not we want to accept them or not.
Absolutely,
but
yeah.
The whole concept of fairy tale is often leveled at the Bible. Mm. But I've heard a lot of thoughtful thinkers actually saying that the real fairy tale, the false, and in terms of myth, not like Lewis thought of myth, but the false tales that we are believing are being told by intellectuals of our culture, leading intellectuals of our culture. Yeah. So one thing it's fascinating to see in your book is how some intellectuals are actually turning back to the Bible, turning away from the myths and the narratives of modernity to the Bible. And it seems, Justin, and this is kind of a relief for me in some sense, that Jesus is turning these people's hearts to his word despite us.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I call them sometimes, you know, prophets from outside the church.
Yeah.
Because it is fascinating to see the way in which as this kind of postmodern turn that culture has taken has kind of started to eat itself. And nowadays, you know, we can all have our own truth and our own identity, but they're all bumping up against each other. Effectively, the way I put it in the book is we're no less religious than we used to be. We just get religious about different things. And it's these new identities and these new causes and, you know, these new identity politics and everything. But the problem is it's that they don't ultimately give us what we're looking for. They don't, you know, we need a bigger story than that to make sense of life. And I think what these thinkers are acknowledging, so these are the people like Jordan Peterson, Jonathan Haidt, John Vavaki, these kind of psychologists, they've identified this meaning crisis, you know, in our culture. And they are interestingly very often pointing people back to something like the Christian story to say, well, here's a way people used to make sense of it. Mm-hmm. Okay. And they're not necessarily people who believe it themselves, but they're kind of, as I said earlier, they're identifying the value in it and that actually this was a more permanent, stable, communal thing that kind of people made sense. And they recognize that people do need something like that. We can't sort of live in this free-floating, kind of chaotic, meaningless void that the atheists kind of told us we live in.
Well, it's funny, too. As you're saying this, I'm reminded of this section in The God Delusion by Dr. Dawkins, where he's actually doing a little bit of... he's actually approving somewhat of having biblical education because the Bible, he's actually speaking highly of the Bible and its literary influence upon our culture, which is a remark in the midst of a tirade against God. He's saying, well, the book through which it came is beautiful.
Yeah. In fact, he actually sponsored a campaign. He put some money towards it of getting the King James Version Bible into every school in the UK. That he's not the first person you'd think would do that, Richard Dawkins, but to give him his credit, he does recognize at least the literary value of the Bible, even if he doesn't believe a word in it.
Right. Well, you had a very, it was almost like watching somebody completely different. Not that he's given up his atheism, but his dialogue with Francis Collins was the most soft and congenial Richard Dawkins I've ever seen.
I was surprised at how mellow he was because I'd kind of obviously encountered him a couple of times before on shows. And he'd been quite, you know, the dogmatic atheist. I think he has mellowed a bit in recent years. And partly it is because of these culture wars, in the sense that I think he's come to realize you know, when he got cancelled by a lot of his secular peers because of his views on transgender, when he got his Humanist of the Year award rescinded by the American Humanist Association in 2021, I think he realized, oh, this kind of cuts both ways. I used to think the Christians were the enemies. It turns out my secular peers can also actually turn on me.
Yeah.
And I think what he enjoyed about that conversation with Francis Collins was that he was just talking to another scientist, actually, someone who actually did believe in truth. But that he knew he could have an honest, gracious conversation. He wasn't going to be cancelled for disagreeing with
Francis Collins. He was hungry for the kind of thing that we're all hungry for, dignity, respect, being treated like a person and not a thing. I imagine that people like Richard have, and to some extent, you, I'm sure you've experienced this as well, where you're like a thing. The technology, the way we are today, we make things out of people, which is an idolatrization of what the human being is. And I think, to Richard's point, his Francis Collins' humane treatment of him.
And not just him, also
other people
his
as well.
Humane treatment of their mutual friend Christopher Hitchens.
Yes,
I think, again, one of the reasons actually why Dawkins said yes when I emailed him to say, would you be interested in a conversation, was because Francis Collins had been a friend of Christopher Hitchens and in his final days had actually helped to extend his life a little during his esophageal cancer. And because he'd done some, you know, genomic analysis and been able to recommend some medicines that extended his life. And I think Richard Dawkins really valued that. And and so much as they obviously still disagree on the God thing, the common humanity that he saw, you know, from Collins was what kind of said, it gave him a great deal of respect for
and
him.
And it just warmed my soul too, because I'm like, this is what Jesus means.
Yeah.
And tonight, you and I are going to go out to dinner. I'm taking you some Texas barbecue.
Looking forward to it.
We are going to be on the President George Bush Turnpike for a few miles. But I bring this up because President Bush Sr., not Jr., was president of the U.S. when the Berlin Wall was taken down. And I remember clearly, I wasn't into politics or anything, but this comment about that from President Bush at the time, he was friends with Mikhail Gorbachev. And he said, this isn't an opportunity for us to dance on the wall, meaning that this is, we have to look at it from the perspective of how phenomenally culturally transformative and maybe to some extent even embarrassing this failure of communism is. This is not a time to poke the bear, to gloat. And I think one of the things that your book reminded me of, Justin, is that though new atheism may be retreating like faith was for Matthew Arnold 150 years ago, we shouldn't, as believers, apologists, and some people are doing this, though, the idea of gloating or bragging or beating our chests that we've won the war because all these people have scampered into the corner.
We haven't at the end of the day.
Right. It's still out there.
It's like there's a whole new battle.
The whole idea of needing to be, and I still struggle with this, and we all do, needing to be respectful, needing to be compassionate, needing to be sincere, needing to be genuine when we are talking to these people who are starved for being treated with dignity.
Absolutely.
You know,
I couldn't agree more. And I think that's, for me, I think it's one of the reasons actually why we've seen the rise as that new atheist story has kind of come off the scene a bit, the rise in popularity of some of these new intellectual thinkers, because they're taking people seriously. They're taking their moral, emotional, psychological selves seriously. They're not just treating them as, you know, just some brain on legs, some kind of rational creature. You know, when Jordan Peterson gets up on a stage and, you know, is sometimes on the verge of tears, you know, addressing his audience, what I think people really resonate with that because they think here's a human being.
His weakness, this fascinated me about him, to your point, and I'll let you continue, but I remember my interest in Dr. Peterson became, I began to be interested in what he was doing because his daughter was cataloging his nervous breakdown. I mean, giving public updates about how her father was doing. The man has been very transparent about his own emotions, and I think he's finally given young men in general an okay, not to seriously confess what you're struggling with and allow the emotions, the validity of a man having emotions, which is something our culture
And this was, I think, the difference between the new atheist and that new approach. Like with you know, Dawkins and Harris, it was kind of like you had to be this intellectual strongman. You had to be this kind of, you know, I have all the answers, I've got it all worked out.
No tears.
Yeah. I think because Jordan Peterson has kind of worn his whole self on his sleeve quite often in public, there's been this kind of transparency, as you say, and that's been quite attractive to people because this is someone who gets me, who I don't think I have it all figured out. I can't be this sort of intellectual know-it-all. And I think there's just something about the fact that he's almost been working out his own faith in public that's quite appealing to people. They feel like they're going on a journey with him, and I find that very helpful. I think that actually there's a lot Christians could learn, actually, because sometimes I think we fall into the same trap of feeling like, well, we have to appear to be,
we have to make the persona seem strong and not vulnerable, and that we solved all the problems,
and we could beat anyone in a debate and all the rest of it.
Right.
And what I noticed actually with all the years of hosting the Unbelievable Show was, you know, while I always enjoyed it, if a Christian, you know, came in and did a good job defending the faith against an atheist, at the same time, there was a value in just people hearing honest conversations where the Christian didn't always win, or it wasn't a slam dunk.
Or I'm not sure about that. Let me get back to that.
Yeah, I was just honest about the fact that they had doubts and there was mystery and so on, because that's just human. That's just normal. And it helps people to realize that is life. It's not all going to be answered and pat answers and, you know, everything sewn up with a tidy bow. So I think sometimes we just need to be a bit more honest about, you know, the search that we're all on, and that we don't have all the answers all the time. And that can actually be more attractive in a funny way to people, because it feels like that you're kind of speaking their language more.
Right. Well, you know, when we read a biography or an autobiography, I think one of the places in those books that we gravitate toward are the person's failures and weaknesses, because we mostly identify with that. We can't really identify with superhuman people that have all the answers. And I don't think that anyone who has Instagram or Facebook or knows social media to any extent would ever think that. It does make it seem like, because of its ubiquity, that everybody's shiny, happy, and smiling. But unfortunately, everybody has that tragic narrative. And that's what I appreciate so much about Alan Noble.
I was having the exact same thought. Yeah. I was thinking, that's what Noble does so well.
He is a Christian Jordan Peterson in the sense of being vulnerable and yet being willing to speak the truth. And it speaks to exactly what the Apostle Paul said, that when he prayed for the thorn in the flesh to be removed, that Jesus said, "My grace is sufficient for you. My strength is made perfect in weakness." And so we can't go on in our own strength, and that's what the whole culture of self does, Justin, and we're collapsing.
Yeah.
Because we're not going on in the strength that Christ provides, because the self was never designed to promote itself. The self was designed, as Alan's book, the title, "You Are Not Your Own."
Yeah.
You were bought with a price.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's so I want to get into this aspect that you spend a lot of time with in the book, and something Alistair McGrath has mentioned, something Alan Noble has mentioned. You all have mentioned the aspect of the narrative, of the story. And we're all familiar and swimming in, maybe we don't know the details of it, but we're all swimming in a postmodern culture where there's it's impossible that there can be one overarching narrative, Justin, for all the disparate, crazy, political, social, militaristic, whatever you want. We're bombarded with headlines that just make our heads spin, and we can't. What kind of story would explain all this?
Yes.
How can anybody claim to know the connectivity of the war with Russia, and or starvation or suffering or great discoveries in the cosmos? How can we make sense of a riot in Los Angeles and the discovery of the cosmic microwave background radiation, which both happened on the same week, by the way?
Yeah.
And it was the philosopher of science, Paul Feyerabend, who was contemplating this very thing. How can we have the Rodney King riots and the destruction of a city where 100 or so people were killed, businesses were ruined, and then we have astronomers giving a press conference about the discovery of the cosmic microwave background radiation, and George Smoot, who got a Nobel Prize for that work, said, if you're religious, it's like seeing the face of God. And Feyerabend's struggling to make the connection between those two things. And in my brain, I'm sitting here because of Michael Ward and Holly Ordway and Lewis and everything that I deep dive into. I saw a connection immediately that the face of God was like that of Rodney King, in the sense that he was beaten and beyond recognition. But yet he's the one, He's the one that created the cosmic microwave background radiation. So the one who created the universe entered our world as a slave.
Yeah.
This is the only kind of narrative, Justin, that, that can work.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do we tell that story?
That's it. And I completely agree with you. I think it's become commonplace almost for people to say we are storytelling creatures. Mm. And I think we are. You know, you get psychologists like Jonathan Gottschall who says, you know, it's just part of nature that we need a story to make sense of ourselves by. If we conceive of ourselves as just bouncing around chaotically without there being some sort of narrative, that's what contributes to the mental health crisis and everything else.
Mm.
But the problem is, it's which story, because there's so many on offer. And as we've said, lots of people want you to embrace their story of reality. And for me, there is this extraordinary ability that the Christian story has had to make sense of all other stories. It is that Lewis thing of, you know, when he had that conversation, that famous conversation with Tolkien, where
Addison's Walk,
the Addison's Walk, which I actually just went round last year with my friend Max.
Nice.
McLean, who plays C.S. Lewis in The Most Reluctant Convert.
Right. Did you have the wind stir the trees while you were walking?
I'd like to think so. we were just chatting and having fun, you know, walking around Addison's Walk. But in that famous conversation, of course, you know, Tolkien helped Lewis to see that all of the mythology and stories that he was so engaged in imaginatively, that actually the Christ was the true myth, the you know, that story.
Mm.
All those other stories were reflections before and after of that true story.
Mm.
And to that extent, I think the Christian story in that sense has this extraordinary resonance and ability to encompass and make sense of so many other stories. Mm. You know, I even saw this when I went to, you know, spent a year out in Africa. You know, African people and tribes there are very different to my Western culture and everything else. And yet the Christian story has managed to embed itself in an incredible way in among the people that I was staying with, in a way that made sense of their story, that made sense for them. There's something about this story that seems to transcend time, place, and culture and be able to speak to everyone. And for me, it's a story that because it is so cosmic and global and can be kind of embedded in ways that don't sort of crush a culture but actually bring out the best in that culture.
Mm.
I find that it is just a miraculous fact of it. It's one of the reasons I am a Christian, because I see this story transforming in so many different places, you know. And for me, how do we in the West, where we've lost that story in the last few hundred years, how do we tell it again to people who I think actually are maybe now primed to hear it again, because the stories they are telling themselves are sort of running out of steam and not working any longer. Lewis was able to do it in his generation to some extent by recasting it through stories like Narnia and other things. He was very imaginative in the way he sort of helped people to kind of taste it, to kind of, you know, imagine it. And I see storytellers today, interestingly, kind of taking up that mantle. One of the people I talk about in the book is Paul Kingsnorth, who is a storyteller, author, poet, celebrated character in the UK, who only 3 years ago became a Christian. And very influenced actually by C.S. Lewis himself. But he'd tried all kinds of other things. He'd sort of had a spell as a teenage atheist, but he just couldn't convince himself that nature was disenchanted. As he said to me. And so he tried Buddhism for much of his adult life, trying to kind of find meaning, transcendence within himself. But again, he said he wanted to worship something. He felt that need to worship. So he thought, maybe I could worship nature. I love nature. I love being in nature. So he went to Wicca and tried doing the Wicca thing, sort of out in the forests, you know, doing the rituals and the chanting and whatever. But he came to eventually see it was a bit of a sort of parody, really, of Christian and, you know,
it's like going into a crystal shop in Venice Beach and sort of pulling a little bit of this and a little bit of that.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. A pastiche of things. And it was fun, but it didn't quite do the job in the end. And then out of the blue, he started having dreams. He started having all kinds of strange conversations coming up with people he didn't realize were Christians but turned out to be. His wife, quite out of the blue, one evening said, "You're going to become a Christian." And he said, "Don't be ridiculous. What are you talking about?" But it happened. And he found himself actually in the end drawn into the Eastern Orthodox Church. And he just describes very movingly his own story of how that just suddenly, that's the story of Christianity suddenly made sense of this sort of search he'd been on, the story he'd been looking for. And he's a storyteller himself, so he understands the power of narrative and story. But he just found that, yeah, in a very C.S. Lewis-like way, suddenly it came together in the story of Jesus Christ. And I see stories like that suggestive that something's going on in the culture. There's this power that the Christian story still has when people are finally ready to hear it. Suddenly it can, overnight, suddenly something happens.